In the session today and the next two sessions tomorrow and Saturday, because this session, this series will go on into Saturday, I'm planning to shift gears a little bit and have a shorter input and have some time for people to discuss in small groups and do some feedback, and particularly for those who wish to, and I hope there will be some who will wish to, the opportunity to really work on some of your own prayer and or poetic language for God, and to share that around in the group a bit. So let me do a bit of introduction and then introduce what I hope to do today in the small groups, and then some time for feedback of that. The basic theme today, as you heard read, is patriarchal monotheism and or, I think it's or, the liberating God. At least I think it's or. So yesterday I was talking about what I called the biblical revolution in God language, in terms of monotheism, over against the ancient Near Eastern background of a polytheistic concept of deity that came in two genders and at least three generations. A concept of transcendence over against a concept of deity that evolved within the cosmos. And then finally, a liberator God over against deity made in the image of a leisured aristocracy. So I saw that as a critical and important shift, and a lot of it takes on a particular significance if you look at it in the context of the ancient Near Eastern religious world, out of which Hebraic culture partially arose, but partially positioned itself against that world. I also suggested that this biblical revolution in God language has moved in different directions. In fact, two very opposite directions. That is still going on today. One direction that I see is that has been a certain kind of classical pattern is to take monotheism and identify the single God with a male God, to identify transcendence with an idea of being over, above, ruling over, disconnected with bodily existence, and to create out of a concept of transcendency and monotheism identified with patriarchal hierarchy, a concept of God that reinforces and in fact is seen as a kind of apex and foundation of a whole social hierarchical order. Hierarchical order of male over female, master over slave, parent, particularly male parent over children, usually thought of as fathers over sons. The mother and the daughter tends to get lost in there, and also culminating in its political expression in kings over subjects, emperors over subjects. So this kind of direction, I think, has identified monotheism and transcendence with monarchy in a political sense, patriarchy, monarchy. I also suggested that the biblical vision, particularly when rooted in the notion of God as a liberator God, God who frees slaves from Egypt, who takes the side of the poor and the oppressed, can and should lead in a very different direction. That monotheism, instead of being identified with maleness, should, I think, on biblical principles themselves, be thought of as a unitary deity, a deity that is the one foundation of all reality. But this one foundation, this one God who is the foundation of all reality, transcends gender, is neither male nor female, and yet is imageable in both genders, that is to say, both men and women are in the image of God, and therefore we must be able to image God in both male and female metaphors without taking either of those literally, without thinking that God therefore is male or is female, keeping in mind that these are metaphors and that God literally transcends gender, and yet we only know personhood in terms of male personhood, female personhood, and so in order to get across that aspect of God as personal, we have to image God in terms of the two kinds of persons that we know. And also linking that with a God who does not simply reinforce and sacralize existing systems of power and powerlessness, but rather is the God who stands in judgment on systems of oppression, a God who stands in judgment on social systems that deprive people of their full humanity, that give some people disproportionate privilege and other disproportionate disprivilege, I guess you would say. A God who does not found that kind of system, but rather speaks through prophets and prophetesses as a critic, as a transformer, as one who leads us to an alternative vision, an alternative hope for a social community, a human community, built on principles of mutuality, on principles of peace and justice. So I think that seems to me is the alternative direction of the biblical revolution in God language, and one in which liberation theologies, as well as I think Christian feminist or biblical feminist theologies, because there's also a Jewish feminist theology that I think is working within distinctly Jewish traditions, but also searching for a similar kind of direction. So to try to summarize what I see a Christian or Jewish feminism, a feminism that is affirming and claiming this direction of biblical faith as in effect normative biblical faith, that it is one that is building on this prophetic liberation tradition, but contextualizing it in the framework of issues of sexism and the full humanity of women and men in some kind of new relationship of mutuality rather than in terms of historical patterns of patriarchy. It therefore sees patriarchy as one of those systems of injustice that was not created by God. Therefore, of course, it's obviously critiquing a whole historical tradition that saw patriarchy as order of creation and created by God. So this is, God doesn't create patriarchy any more than God creates slavery or racism. That these are unjust systems, and that the liberator God of biblical faith is leading us to fuller and fuller visions, fuller understandings of our redeemed humanity, and that we now have to include in that genuine mutuality of men and women, not simply as personal relationships, although that certainly is a very key part of it, but these have to be embodied in just social systems. Just social systems that support the full human development of men and women. Now, how might that be expressed in terms of God language? In other words, how do we start re-imaging God to express this fuller vision? What I'd like to do now is just give us what I see as a series of principles, you might say, about a liberating and inclusive God language. I think, first of all, and very importantly, is we have to realize that all of our God language is metaphor. That is to say, no God language can be taken literally. All of our God language is drawn from human experiences of created things. we no one has seen God. Therefore, we have no literal verbal image for God. But all of our images are drawn from human experiences of created things. And therefore, they are only partly appropriate for God. If they're taken literally, they are idolatrous. And so it's only insofar as we remember that gap between any image and God can we use it appropriately as a kind of, you know, we always have to say, this is like God. Not God is a father, God is like a father. Or God is like a cool breeze, or you know, whatever. But not God is. So to have that kind of understanding, that theological reservation. And this is obviously no new principle. This has been a classical principle of Christian theology, to understand God language as analogical was the traditional term. But I think that kind of critique has tended not to be really applied when it came to issues of gender images. And we've even had, eminent bishops, such as the late Bishop of San Francisco, who said that women could not be ordained because the priest images God, and the key aspect of God's activity, get this now, is begetting. And since women don't beget, women just can't image God. Now there are obviously several problems with a penetrating statement. It's inseminating a seminal thought.
I get to trust.
And he was rather surprised when there was a kind of cry of horror and outrage at this statement. He died shortly after. So that's an example of how even bishops sort of take these images literally and obviously use them in a very political way to say, you can't, do this because you don't have this particular male function. So to really kind of get clear about that apophatic was the traditional term. That's it.
Oh.
Apophatic means to say, and apo means not. So a kind of reservation of whenever any language is applied to God. That recognizes that this is a partial image, but is not taken literally. A second obvious point, which I've already mentioned, is to be clear that God is imageable in both genders because both genders are images of God, but God is not literally either male or female. And so we need images for God which are gender inclusive, which is to say that they are images of God that do not suggest that God is literally only of one gender, namely the male gender. And I think there has been one kind of strategy for doing this, which one finds in a lot of inclusive language lectionaries and hymnals and so on. I think it has been the dominant way of creating inclusive language. I happen to think it's not the best way. And I think it also tends to cause people to have a lot of feelings of alienation and hostility toward inclusive language for God. Even people who sort of get the theological point that language for God should be inclusive tend to feel alienated from this way of doing it. And the way I'm talking about it is to get to think of inclusive language as increasingly abstract, gender-neutral language. In other words, you try to get away from gendered language by moving to increasingly abstract categories. And so, for example, in the inclusive language lectionary that was developed by the National Council of Churches, I think with all very good scholarship, goodwill, and so on, I don't critique their efforts at all. But I think it's a beginning that I think we can go beyond. And very, very typically, they tended to go for this kind of abstract generic. so they would translate the word Lord, for example, into the word sovereign. That's a kind of further abstraction. A Lord, still, you sort of visualize a human person. And the word Lord obviously comes from a male aristocracy, although most of us, because we don't know any lords, don't tend to think of that as like an English lord. We've tended to personalize that word, and shall we say, warm it up a bit, you know, the Lord. Where sovereign suddenly hits you, you know, like this kind of cold fish. I mean, it does me. Sovereign. I mean, I can't warm up to a sovereign very much. I was mentioning this when I was talking. I spoke about this in Canada, and some of my Canadian friends laughed very long and loud and said, "Well, we think of a sovereign as someone distant, powerless, and female." And I repeated that same remark in England, and they didn't laugh in England. In fact, they looked extremely uncomfortable at the thought that the Canadians might think of our sovereign as distant and impotent, obviously female. So, I mean, I think part of the problem with this, you know, doing sort of textbook translations like, oh Lord, let's use sovereign, is that you don't pay attention to all of the contextual meanings of a word as it hits any particular culture. I think there's several problems with that kind of strategy of moving from male words to abstract sort of neutral generics. First of all, I think there's lurking under the neutral generic is often still a male generic presupposition, because in English, generics are male. So if you say, you know, God is not male, God, he is spirit, you know, you discover that there's still a kind of presupposition of maleness underneath generic words. Secondly, I think the increasing abstraction violates the basic nature of religious language, which, like poetic language, is concrete. It's experiential language. It's language that is supposed to touch your feelings, not just, you know, be passed through sort of logical formulas in your head. And so when you get increasingly abstract, you increasingly get away from any language that really makes people feel anything that connects with their real life. So I think the abstract generic language comes out of a sort of abstract theological mind which has forgotten that religious language is poetic language. So my strategy for inclusive language is, I don't say that occasionally a more genetic generic language, a word might not be okay. I mean, I don't say that that's always to be ruled out, but I think it's a more positive strategy to move toward a plurality of concrete symbols rather than trying to find one neutral generic abstraction. And I think that to move toward a plurality of concrete symbols for God retains much more and allows one a much more of a fluidity of poetic images. It's actually, of course, much closer to biblical language itself, which uses not one image, but a plurality of metaphors, plurality of images, drawn not only from male and female persons, but also drawn from all kinds of experiences of nature. To reach for a much more creative poetic language that remains concrete, but has a plurality of images. And I think that helps people to understand that language for God is poetic and metaphorical and not to be taken literally. If you say, within the same liturgy, if you say God, who is both mother and father to us, and later on you talk about God as like a burning fire and bread and water and so on, and people begin to get the point that this is poetic language, that we're not asking, the exact mineral content of the water in God or something like that. So that's my sort of recommendation for prayer and liturgy writers, is to move more in the direction of a plurality of concrete images rather than trying to find such one definitive, abstract, generic word that's going to fit the bill for all times and places. I think in addition to that plurality of metaphors, we have to then ask the question of what is appropriate and what is inappropriate metaphor. Is everything in the world sort of raw material for metaphors of the divine? I think everything in the world is raw material insofar as it sort of reflects, shall we say, created goodness. Which is to say human beings and trees and animals and all kinds of basic good experiences. I think what is problematic images for God is images drawn from social systems which are historically unjust social systems. And so it's precisely these kind of metaphors that I find problematic, but in fact a great deal of our God language has been built on these kind of metaphors, namely language for God built on master-slave, patriarchal father-children, which is not to say good fatherhood, and I'll be talking about that tomorrow, the difference between patriarchal fatherhood and good fatherhood. I think good fatherhood and motherhood are appropriate metaphors, but patriarchal fatherhood is not. So language for God built on master-slave, patriarchal fatherhood, child relationships, obviously king-servant relationships, and so on. In other words, these are images that suggest that image God after a kind of dominating power that reduces people to a servile dependency rather than a kind of redeeming power. A redeeming power which leads us to our fuller possibilities, which helps us shake off our sinful encapsulation. So I think I'm not saying that one shouldn't use language that suggests God has a little bit more power than we do. but rather we should ask what kind of power relationship we're imaging. Is it a power relationship of domination and servility, or is it a power relationship that is empowering, redeeming, opening us up to our fuller potential and our openness to one another? And I think it's only the latter kind of power language is appropriate for God. The first kind of power language really makes God the creator and sanctifier of unjust systems. And that means, I think, also that when we're reaching for gender metaphors in terms of images and roles of men and women, we need to try to break apart or go beyond in some way images of males and females that simply reduplicate traditional stereotypic masculinity and femininity, which is to say, a language for God that says God is like a strong, angry father and like a loving, gentle mother is a kind of language that just sort of fixes men and women in rigid boxes and sort of reinforces the truncated human development which patriarchy has created. It doesn't allow men to be loving, sensitive people. It doesn't allow women, obviously, to have very much brains and autonomy and so on. So I think that while we need to find metaphors that bring in male and female, we need to, in a sense, break apart, sort of break open a lot of our traditional imagery of masculinity and femininity. Sometimes that means reaching for kind of paradoxical phrases. I like some of Holly Near's language, for example, and I think we can pay attention to some of the contemporary feminist poets and songwriters. I mean, the church has always known how to steal a good tune. And, and we should keep on doing that today. So things like, we are gentle, angry people, for example. That kind of language, in effect, breaks apart the kind of stereotypic gentleness is for women, anger is for men, allows us to really say we are gentle, angry people. We are gentle people, and we are angry at violence. and sort of reunify that kind of wholeness of humanity, which we have tended to destroy through stereotypic dualisms of masculinity and femininity. In other words, again, I think what we really need very much in the church is poets. And what we've tended to have is committees. Now, committees do the best they can, but you sort of know it. You know, the old joke about a camel is an animal created by a committee. Well, some of our efforts to do inclusive language lectionaries and translations and so on have that sort of camel aspect. There's kind of a lot of bumps, you know, and you really cry out for a poet. So I think we need to really reach for the poets who can create, who can understand the in effect the demands of the spirituality of our times, and can find the new images to express that. And that's part of what I hope you folks will do, at least try to do in the next couple of days. So what I'd like to suggest is, maybe 56 people here. If people could kind of gather in groups of about 10 or so, we have a half an hour, and in about 12 minutes, simply kind of brainstorm words and images, which you would find meaningful to you as prayer language, but images that have some aspect of being female identified. Now, when I say female identified, I don't mean in a kind of narrow sense, simply a mother or something. One can do a lot of much broader imagery. The reason why I'm asking you to think female identified language is, shall we say, a kind of linguistic affirmative action here. Because we've had so much, such a preponderance of male imagery, and then we've had some efforts to do neutral imagery, but we really need a kind of imagination to be let loose on female-identified imagery, not because that's the only place we want to go, but because we need to create a fuller, richer language. So I'd like if people could just gather and brainstorm female-identified imagery that you would find prayable, something that you would really find prayable. And then we'll get back for the last, 18 minutes. It's really be 15 minutes. And just have people feed some of those images in, and I'm sure you, in the process, you'll want to raise some questions about that too. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of questions that are right on the tip of your tongue, but I'd like to try to have this process happen and then try to field some of those questions. Is that okay? Images that people come up with that none of the rest of you will have thought of.
We couldn't get started. Yeah.
Well, I got that feeling that people were kind of blowing off and taking off.
The latest one, Cosmic Gallery.
Okay, why don't you start with your, just read through, we'll just read through quickly the list, even if there's overlap.
Confidant, envelope, rushing water force, gentle force, dependable friend, comforter, life sparker, ever-flowing brook, artesian well, mourner, infolder. Journey, Eternal Breast, Landmark, Teacher, Song, Polaris, Alchemist, Roaring Womb, Kindly Disciplinarian, Great Intuitive, Tent, Nurturing Rain, Nurturer, Caregiver, Desire, Ever-Present, Creatrix, Spider, Divine Matrix, Creative Life Force, Moon Sustainer, Sustainer, Carrier, Baker Woman, Protector.
Baker Woman.
A Baker Woman. That's a Baker Woman. Other group? What are some of it?
You want me just to give ones that I didn't remember hearing in that list?
Okay.
But we had Nurturer and Nurturing. We had Weaver, Potter, Bearer, Fruitful, Midwife, Nursing and Nurse, Healer, Comforter, Comforting, and we had Mommy, Cuddly, Graceful, Loving Kindness, Expectant, Nurturing Milk of Life, Courageous Life Giver. I think that's about all that's.
Okay. Over here.
We've written it in more sentence form.
That's right, sure. Just whatever.
You who birth each of us into life, O God, who bonds us to you by your loving care and tenderness, you who provide the milk of your loving kindness. O God, you are our helpmeet. You are the intuitive being who always has empathy for us and knows our thoughts without our speaking. You who prepare a table before us and sing us to sleep are the one who is there when we are hurt and when we dream visions.
Well, I think that you've got a point right there. You just, I mean, it's interesting. It all really goes together as one piece.
Yeah.
And that might turn up in a test
person. That's much more powerful than just individual images. Having no trouble connecting to it when you put together, an image of this being doing something for me. And that was really powerful.
Because a lot of these, for example, images, they're just disconnected. You don't really know how they might be used until you start putting them, making the building blocks of some kind of prayer form. Okay. Any other?
Well, they've utilized most of ours.
We had the largest group, and so we continued to do it as a committee.
We had Cosmic Bowery, and that's
any group up there have any contribution?
Give her a peace.
Say it again.
Give her a peace.
Give her a peace.
Ever-flowing stream.
Ever-flowing
stream.
Uh-huh.
It was so funny that so many of them came up with the Indian concept, and we were talking about that in our group, how the Indian society had evidently done this many centuries ago. But their interpretation of God is so narrow, though. I mean, they're praying to individual God rather than a supreme God.
Well, I don't know. I think a lot of people we call polytheists really have a sense of a kind of underlying divine reality, and then the plurality is more the manifestation or something. So, but I think sometimes we've made polytheists stupider than they really are, you might say.
Or made them polytheists when they're really not in the undergird. Is what you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wonder whether. I mean, certainly, I know that. That in the Greco-Roman world, there was very much a sense that all of these gods were sort of the manifestations of one divine power that expressed itself in plurality. So I think many people have that intuition, but monotheists have tended to assume that these people just thought of these as just separate gods and had no sense of an underlying unity. But I think one of the key problems that any kind of religion is trying to express is some kind of connection between unity and plurality. I mean, what we experience is a plurality of things. And if you say, if you reduce it to one unity, you tend to reduce it to something that has no particularity at all. So I think that the effort to kind of bridge the experience of plurality and unity is one of the issues of God language or theology. Christianity bridges it with something called the Trinity, which is a way to bridge unity and plurality. You have a question?
It's not related there, but yesterday or the other day, I heard you say that in the Jewish people are offended to hear, you know, Yahweh, that it's an unspoken word, which I heard also, but then the thought's been hitting me all the time. How do they read the scriptures before a group can come across that?
But what it is not a word called Yahweh. What it is the four consonants without any vowels, which means you can't pronounce it. And it simply sort of sits there as a symbol, and what is read is not any effort to pronounce that symbol, but rather what is read is a circumlocution. Adonai or some other word, that's what's read. And so you very deliberately never pronounce or attempt to pronounce that particular symbol, but you use a circumlocution. One of my friends who's a Jewish theologian that's very much engaged in trying to do very much the same thing I'm trying to do in Christianity, I guess, and that's Art Waskow, a Judaism that's on the side of equality of men and women and care for the earth and struggle against militarism and all that kind of stuff. And that, I guess I said his name is Arthur Waskow, and he's very much a part of trying to do new liturgical worship things. He's done new settings of the Passover, the Seder. Anyway, getting all back to the symbol for God, they decided that instead of using any word to express that would be a circumlocution, but would also tend to be traditionally a male word. What they would do is come as close to pronouncing that without pronouncing it, which is simply to take a long breath. So in his seders, if you would just take those consonants without any vowels, what you get is a kind of a breath. And then that connects with the whole idea of the spirit as breath and breath of life and so on. And so that's what they used in that Seder. Now, it would be a little hard to, you know, preach with that word, but it does very much work around a table setting liturgy, which is what a Seder is. So I found that a very creative idea. When they got to that point, they would just breathe together.
I've seen that used at Pentecost time in singing where breath is actually used to kind of inculcate or embody the spirit to get some flesh and singing. It's very effective and it's very good.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I found that very interesting.
Can I do one more?
For sure.
And that's the derivative of the word God itself, C-O-D. Where did that, you know where that came from or what it...
Well, I assume it's Anglo-Saxon Germanic.
Yeah,
I mean, the German word for Gott, you know, and the Greek words in Latin is Deus, Theos, and so on.
I heard it mentioned as that it meant literally a cry.
A cry? Any
a cry
Anglo-Saxon, any Aryans, linguistic scholars around here? I don't know what the derivation is. Gott. In my book, Sexism and God Talk, I had the feeling that if we use the word, just the word G-O-D, God, is so identified in our mind with the male image, that I created a word that's G-O-D/ESS, but which is, one might pronounce God goddess, but not just goddess, which would only make it female. But a part of the idea was to create a kind of a word that would force people to break just the male image, but without just saying that God is female either.
I've lost where I heard that, but it was like to cry out, you know.
Uh-huh. That was... Well, that's interesting. Any sort of questions about, you might say, the whole issue of searching for larger God language?
It's your thesis, too, as I listen to that the language we use of God can perpetuate justice or injustice. That words have power.
Yeah, I think words have power. I mean, words, of course, can be endlessly co-opted. I mean, if you get good words, but you use them in a bad system, what you tend to do is that the words gradually become co-opted into the bad system. And so I think there always has to be a kind of dynamic interaction between the reach for new words and the search for more authentic living. I mean, there has to be a kind of an ethical action dimension, or what's sometimes called a praxis dimension. And if people think that it's enough just to change the language without really changing the practice, what you find is that the words just slip back into being a kind of code language for something else. And I think you can see this in some of the feminist efforts. For example, the word Ms., which was an effort to get a word for women that overcame the fact that women are always identified with whether they're married or unmarried, whether men or not. Well, very quickly I found that on all kinds of programs and so on, the women who are identified as feminists would all be called Ms. And the women who weren't feminists would be called Mrs. And so the word had become a code language to identify feminists rather than a general word. Or an earlier example, obviously, is some of Jesus' own creative efforts to open up language, to talk about Christ as a servant rather than a Lord, but how quickly we have co-opted the word servant into a kind of a new clerical elite called the ministry, and so that we really have lost the whole larger critical aspect of what was being said by the word servant, and so on. So I think there has to be always a kind of dynamic interconnection between new language and ethical practice.
Has the search for new language been a historical thing that's happened several times before?
Well, I think that this is always the case because people are always trying to. They're trying to make the religious experience a living experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that perhaps a tradition goes along for a certain period, living off the creative new language created by.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, the language has become so co-opted into systems of meaning or political power structures that have kind of corrupted it, that you need a kind of a new breakthrough, a new renewal, which tends also to, in other words, whenever you're trying to renew the meaning of something, you're doing some language stuff. And I think Jesus was doing language stuff. I mean, he was reaching for creative transformations to make the story live again. And I think that's really what we're talking about, is making the message live.
Thank you. Very good.
Okay.